thumbing their noses at higher gas prices for good reason. Larry Compo is a professor of consumer psychology at Clarkson University.
We've had a brutal winter in many parts of the country. All this kind of wears on our psyche, and we feel a need for a relief, a change. So I think the pain of weather is trumping the pain at the pump.
But Americans will also be keeping a tighter grip on their wallets. They'll eat sandwiches out of a cooler instead of going into a restaurant, or stay with friends instead of a hotel. And analysts say that could hurt businesses that depend on those travel dollars. For NPR News, I'm Danielle Carson in Washington.
Stocks are holding on to gains on Wall Street. The Dow is currently up 45 points. The Nasdaq is up 15. I'm Craig Windham, NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from the George Lucas Educational Foundation, creator of Edutopia, a source for what works in education. Learn more at edutopia.org.
Bicycle, bicycle, bicycle.
Congratulations, Champaign-Urbana. Nearly 900 of you rode your bike to work or school on May 3rd. More than half of you were new participants in Bike to Work Day, and 14% of you used bicycles as transportation to and from work for the very first time. For bicycling tips from area residents, visit willconnect.org/projects.
Good morning. Welcome to Focus. This is our morning talk show. My name is David Inge. Glad to have you with us. The program today, all of the program comes from the archives. In the second hour, we'll have something a little special. This is the thing that we've been calling the Deep Archives Project. In celebration of our 30th anniversary, we're re-airing some of the oldest programs that we have recorded. And these are programs that are not on the web archive. And they're both about beauty, two very different views of beauty. From 1991, Naomi Wolf talking about her book, The Beauty Myth. And then from 2000, Nancy Etcoff, author of the book Survival of the Prettiest. So that's our number two. In the first hour, we have a more recent archive. This is one first presented in March. So as you listen, do keep in mind that this morning we'll not be taking calls. For the first time in human history, there are more people who live in cities than who live in rural areas. And that is the result of the biggest movement of people that the world has ever seen. In his new book, Doug Saunders, who's a journalist, looks at the entry point for many of these people. And he's coined a term for this. He calls it arrival city, and that is the title of the book. This is a place, he says, where the transition between poverty and wealth takes place and where the next generation's dreams are created. So this morning, Doug Saunders will describe this place that exists in many cities around the world, and he's visited many of them, places including cities in China, in Africa, in India, Latin America, in the United States. The book is Arrival City. The subtitle is How the Largest Migration in History is Reshaping Our World. Pantheon is the publisher. Doug Saunders is an award-winning journalist and the European Bureau Chief of the Globe and Mail newspaper, and he's joining us this morning by telephone. And Doug Saunders, thank you very much.
Really good to be with you.
I'm glad I somehow managed to get the right show here. Oh, yeah, well, that's the way it is.
I was prepared to talk about loyalists as well. I actually have some among my descendants, being as many Canadians do. So, that was another interesting historical migration. But I'm focusing here on human population movement of larger scope that's taking place right now.
And this, I think, you know, one of the things that attracted me to talking about this was that it's something that certainly it needs attention, but I think something that needs to be, people need to be aware of. And when you talk about the scope of this, just how big a demographic movement it is, that you do talk about it being the biggest movement of people in history, and something that will lead to what you argue would be a permanent kind of change about where most of the people on the planet Earth live.
That's right. Europe and the United States and Canada and Australasia went through this change starting around the time of the French Revolution and until the middle of the 20th century. We shifted from being a place where the majority of the population were peasant farmers to a place where the majority of people were urban in the broader sense of the word, and a minority were engaged in agriculture designed to produce food rather than support the people living on the land. We forget that 200 years ago, starvation level malnutrition was a commonplace thing in the rural areas of the Western world. It was this urban shift that ended that, that caused the Industrial Revolution, the end of poverty as a major phenomenon in the West, and also a lot of revolutionary conflict, violence, urban misery, and so on. Right now, and we're about halfway through the same shift occurring in the eastern and southern quarters of the world. The other four-fifths of the world's population are now at the peak of this transition. After World War II, the developing world, Asia, the Indian subcontinent, Africa, the Middle East, and South America, were about three-quarters rural and mainly peasant farmers. That is, people who farm for their own families and starve if they don't manage to. That shift has now taken us to the point where the world is 50-50 rural-urban. We passed that threshold at some point during the last 5 years. And during the next 40 years or so, we will see it, this shift speed up quite a lot, to the point that by mid-century, it'll be nearly complete. Certainly by the end of this century, barring something like a Third World War, the entire world will be as urban as the West is, and so on. And this is largely a beneficial shift. I mean, it's what is ending poverty and so on. I mean, large-scale poverty and starvation-level malnutrition are rural phenomena. They happen to people who are subsistence farmers for the most part, very much less so in cities. World population growth is a phenomenon of rural economies. That's where the families are that are of expanding size. When countries urbanize, their population stops growing, starts shrinking. What is going to cause the human population of the world to stop growing will be this urbanization. So we need to pay attention to it. But I should note that, I mean, the way I'm looking at this is not as a bunch of demographics and statistics, although I examine those, but I am providing a tour in a rival city of the places where this is taking place. I go to about 20 places on five continents and tell the stories of the transition, look at the neighborhoods, especially where this population shift is taking place.
And here, I think it's worth underscoring what really this is about in the largest possible sense, that this is about something that is a pretty basic human impulse and something that has been a basic human impulse for really a long time. And so what we're talking about here is increasing magnitude of this trend. But I'm sure that for a very, very long time, people have moved from the farm, from the village, from the rural area to the city in search of a better life. And that's basically what we're talking about here.
That's the underlying force. But you have to realize that the communities where this takes place, the urban neighborhoods that still have one foot in the village, are not simply places where a families move en masse into the city. That's not the way it happens, and it never has. You get links to the village that usually begin with one or two people from the family, from the village, setting up in the city, sometimes in the most rudimentary way, sleeping on the sidewalk or in a packed dormitory room, to get a little extra urban income to support the village. This happens both within countries and internationally. You know, a lot of Latin Americans come to the United States initially as one or two people providing income, slowly bringing in other members of the family, using the income from the urban low-level urban work, both to finance improvements in the village and to finance further moves of people into the city. So the neighborhood that I'm calling the arrival city, which is the bottom rung urban neighborhood, serves two functions in two directions. First of all, it supports the initial village both in its improvements and in its future immigrations. But then second of all, it tries to establish links into the core economy of the city by setting up small businesses, by trying to get children into the education system and the political system and so on. It's the instrument of social mobility, this bottom rung neighborhood. And we know it in the West as the immigrant startup neighborhood, the Lower East Side, or the many Irish and German and Italian and Polish and Eastern European Jewish immigrant neighborhoods of Chicago, for example, all started out this way with a relationship to an originating village. So I'm I'm trying to come up with a universal theory of the bottom-rung immigrant neighborhood in a rival city by examining what makes these places work and what makes them fail.
Doug Saunders is our guest. He's an award-winning journalist, and he is the European Bureau Chief of the Globe and Mail newspaper. He is the author of the book, Arrival City, the subtitle, How the Largest Migration in History is Reshaping Our World. Pantheon is the publisher. Questions welcome, 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. You can join us here at any point during the conversation. Questions are welcome. You coined this term, Arrival City, as I think you were looking for something that would more accurately describe the phenomenon as you saw it. And certainly there are other terms that have been applied to these places, and generally they are not positive. Slum probably would be one of the nicer ones. But you said that you make the argument here, as hard as it might be for some people to understand, that life in these arrival cities is better for them than life in the village, and this is a really very dynamic place, and it is this place where, as you just said, people, they still maybe still have one foot, relatively speaking, in the village, but also one poised to make the step out of the arrival city into the middle class and to what they hope is a much bigger, better standard of living and better life for their kids.
That's right. That's the default mode of existence for the arrival city neighborhood. As squalid as an Asian slum may appear, and certainly the sanitary and health situations in these neighborhoods are dire, and the people who live there know that. I mean, people know what they're missing. They are an improvement on the village life, often an order of magnitude improvement in terms of income, child mortality, longevity, HIV/AIDS rates, empowerment of women very much, of course. People are there because they paid to be there. And in most slums in the developing world, the people who live there own their shacks, not necessarily fully legally, but they've bought them from someone, and they use the rising property value of them as a source of credit to finance small businesses and so on, much as middle-class people do in North America. And there's often huge amounts of economic activity inside them. I mean, I open the book inside a self-built shantytown neighborhood in Chongqing, the enormous city in the center of China, that has maybe 200,000 people clustered in haphazard and smelly self-built buildings, and hundreds of little factories inside, businesses where people are making things, some of which have, 10 or 15 computer-controlled steel milling machines inside them making motorcycle parts or so on. There's serious business inside that. And you'll find that inside the slums of India and Bangladesh and Brazil and so on. Huge amounts of activity going on as people find ways to link themselves into the main economy of the city. That's the plan. People don't come from a village to live in the slum of a city just to sit there and live in misery. They have specific plans. They have ambitions. They've saved a lot to be there. They have some idea as to how to have children, their children get a better education and a better life. I mean, one of the indicators of this is the amount of cable TV penetration in terrible slums without toilets or running water. One out of four families typically has cable TV, even though they don't have any chance of a toilet. Why? A number of reasons, but in good part because these are aspirational neighborhoods. And when they fail, as they so often do, this is not entirely an optimistic book. I mean, I find we're generally blowing it around the world. But when these neighborhoods fail, it's not because they're destined or doomed or because they contain people who are failures. It's because something has been placed in the way of the natural ambitions of the neighborhood. And we need to learn what these obstacles are and how to get them out of the way. Or we'll run into conflict.
Well, let's save that for a minute, because I think that's an important point here. And there are illustrations from history about how governments have either dealt with the arrival city well or not, and about how that can make a big difference. But just to take a step back, what sort of things for people who come and live in these neighborhoods and these places, what sort of things do they do for a living? How do they manage to make money?
You get a lot of employment on the bottom end of industry, garment manufacturing and so on. You get a lot of domestic service and so on as bottom-rung work. And this is an indication as to what can make these places succeed or failure. You need to have transportation links. whether it's the high-rise outskirts of Washington, D.C., or the slums of Sao Paulo. Adding efficient minibus service and so on can actually transform a place more dramatically than any sort of welfare intervention or so on. But also, they engage in small business to a very large extent and light industry. And it's not as if every poor immigrant family is some bold entrepreneur. I mean, maybe it's one family out of 20, but one family out of 20 is enough to employ most of the other families and so on. So it's very important in very poor immigrant neighborhoods to recognize the importance of small business. The reason why the Italians and Irish and Jews of the 20th century in the United States succeeded in poor urban neighborhoods is because they were able to open shops and restaurants and small factories and so on within their residential neighborhoods that had customers coming from the established city economy that were able to trade with the established city, that were able to get set up without too many zoning or licensing requirements and so on. This is very much true in the developing world as well. The new immigrant thing to do in a city very much is to set up a small business, very usually flexibly within space that is often residential as well. And the ability to do this is often the difference between success or failure of a neighborhood. I mean, these are places of rudimentary capitalism. And in a way, there's a message that although I think there are important investments that governments need to make in these transitional neighborhoods in terms of infrastructure and transportation and education, there's also some areas where governments need to get out of the way. There needs to be a lot less zoning. There needs to be an understanding that immigrant neighborhoods need to be very flexible and a little bit chaotic and so on. We need to learn to do what the Dutch did to solve the problems of the very troubled outskirts of Amsterdam, which was actually to make them a little bit more like a developing world slum in some respects, and allowing teeming markets to form on the ground floor of the apartment buildings, allowing people to use their housing as industry or as retail, and increasing the housing density, allowing people to live much closer together in straight grid streets in a physical space that allows arts and culture and industry and commerce to mix with housing.
Well, you made the arguments that if there are problems with these arrival cities, and certainly there are, that it may in large part be because governments put up roadblocks to these people's success. And we can talk about what some of those things are. But I was really struck, I think it's really quite fascinating, where you look at several places, Brazil and Turkey, for example, and you can look at how it is they dealt with these kinds of settlements and how it is they dealt with them at one point badly and later well, and how that actually connected with life in the country as a whole, how it was governed, and that by making a change, it profoundly changed the politics right at the very level of the top government in those two places.
That's right. I mean, Brazil and Turkey are now countries governed by the arrival city class. In the case of Turkey, and Brazil, until Lula da Silva ended his presidency last year, they were countries governed for a decade by people who were children of the arrival city. And this produced a decade of democratic stability, economic growth, growing trade, and increasing integration of the poor in both of those countries. After decades, I should add, of extremely violent conflict, and in both of these countries, military dictatorships that arose from conflict in the arrival city neighborhoods, in the favelas of Brazil, the Gece Kondu of Turkey, and so on. And increasingly around the world, we're seeing these conflicts where the new up-and-coming, very, very lower middle class of the arrival city neighborhood comes into conflict with the old middle class of the regime established class. And I should note that the Egyptian revolution that began on January 25th this year was very much a product of the arrival city. It was in the neighborhoods in Cairo known as the Ashwayat, which means chaotic place, particularly in a neighborhood called Boulak, just to the west of central Cairo, which is a slum neighborhood formed by villagers from Upper Egypt who built extremely dense and labyrinthine structures of housing on the edge of the city. It was that neighborhood that sent the first crowds of people to Tahrir Square to occupy it, and it had a long history of uprisings against the regime. Why? Because the class of people who had set up shops and small factories and so on in this chaotic neighborhood were trying to get their children into education, trying to get work opportunities, trying to get business opportunities, and were constantly crushed down by the Mubarak regime, which had a protected, regime-controlled or state-owned industrial economy that provided good jobs for the regime's own middle class, but kept these people out and had continuously tried to rehouse these people in high-rise places on the outskirts of the city, to treat them as a threat to the legitimate businesses of the city, and so on. And this frustration welled up and exploded into the protests that began on the 25th. And what we're seeing in the Arab world, and I've just returned from Tunisia and Libya looking at this, is very much, in many cases, I would not include Libya in this, but in most other cases, a case of the arrival city class conflicting with the regime class. The young man who set himself on fire in Tunisia late last year, beginning this wave of revolutions, was a pure child of the arrival city, a young man with one house in a village somewhere, living with his family in rudimentary quarters in a small city or large town, trying to make his living in classic arrival city fashion by selling fruit on the streets and so on, and running into bureaucrats and police from the regime who are trying to stop this rural migrant economy from forming and so on. And his suicide at the frustration of this was the root of the revolution. So really, these neighborhoods are often at the center of either the shift to political stability or the shift into chaos and transformation and revolution around the world.
Well, that's I think that's a fascinating point. And I also wanted to ask you about the Iranian revolution, because I know that you've said that, to take that revolution, for example, that was something that was you said what happened there in Iran was directly the result of mismanaging this transition from rural to urban.
Yes, very much so. And Iranians know this. I spent a good amount of time in Tehran on arrival city, looking at both what happened in 1979 and what's happening now in the southern outskirts neighborhoods of the city, which formed very quickly and very chaotically in the 1970s when the Shah basically force urbanized the country, which was not a great idea, I should say. I mean, when I say that a shift to urban life is an improvement in almost every respect in countries, force urbanizing people is it generally doesn't work. People need to be able to form their own economies and make it work for them on their own. You had a huge shift of people into the city in Tehran, and really no right to own housing, no access to the business opportunities of the city, and a huge frustration in southern Tehran. And essentially what happened in 1979 was it was a contest to take this anger from the arrival city and direct it into a political resistance. And it was the Islamist parties of the Ayatollah Khomeini who were able to seize that anger and that demand for the right to own your house or your self-built shack and used it. But there wasn't that much overwhelming interest in having a theocratic regime among these people. They just wanted to have housing rights. They briefly got them, although at the moment there's a lot of frustration in the southern outskirts of Tehran, which is by now a fully urbanized country, Iran is. But there's frustration now at further attempts by the Ahmadinejad government to restrict housing and business rights and so on. So we're seeing a repeat of those frustrations. And southern Tehran was a significant, although not dominant, part of the uprisings of that began in 2009.
We are at our midpoint here, and let me again introduce the guests for this hour of Focus, Doug Saunders. He's an award-winning journalist. He's the European Bureau Chief of the Globe and Mail newspaper, and he's the author of the book Arrival City, How the Largest Migration in History is Reshaping Our World. Pantheon is the publisher. It's just out, and the title is something that that he coined. That is the term, arrival city. He coined that term because apparently he felt that there was really no good word to express what it was he wanted to express. Talking about these kinds of areas and neighborhoods that we see around major cities around the world, and not just in the developing world. Over a period of 3 years, he visited about 20 of these places, these arrival cities, and their connected villages on five continents. And as I say, this is not just a phenomenon that you see in the developing world. He also, in his writing and his travels, has included arrival cities in France and in the United States and other places as well. This is a major trend of people moving from the villages and from rural areas to the city, the biggest demographic shift, he says, in human history, and that it is very much connected to the total economic system of the country, both life back in the village where people come from and what life is like elsewhere in the big city. Questions are welcome, 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. I want to have you talk some more about what this change will mean for the villages from which people come. So I think you make some really important points. You did a little bit earlier in the conversation about the fact that modern poverty is really a rural phenomenon. It is at the root of the world hunger problem. Mm-hmm. And that if there has been the fact that there has been a decline in world poverty is, in fact, the result of urbanization. So if this trend continues to happen and more people, not everybody, but more and more people move from the village to the city, what does this mean now for life back in the village?
We need to look at what happened to our own villages, of course, which is they became much less populated, and they became places largely devoted to the business of producing food if they're in agricultural areas. And we're used to this idea of rural life, not realizing that in much of the world, the village is a place of survival, and often bare survival. I mean, I think people tend to see urban poverty as looking worse because it's less photogenic, let's put it that way. But the people living in slums, if things go very badly, and they sometimes do, then you may have to send your kids out to sell individual cigarettes on the street or something demeaning like that. If things go badly in the village, your children die. And this is the arithmetic around the world. You look at a country like Bangladesh with 162 million people. It is a huge net importer of food, despite the fact that 80% of its people live in agricultural villages. It is an enormous importer of food. Why can't it produce enough food to feed its own people? Because it has so many people living on the land. Agricultural underinvestment because it's based on survival rather than people. Now, you see changes. If you go up to, as I did in Arrival City, up to Sylhet, which is the district in the upper right-hand corner of Bangladesh, a tiny little area that's thoroughly rural, you see a huge amount of agricultural investment and shifts to forms of farming that actually produce large amounts of food. Why? Because about one family in 10 there has moved to Britain, mainly to East London, and works in the economy there. And the remittances coming from them and from other families who are in the Persian Gulf are enough to finance a huge agricultural transformation. In fact, Bangladesh gets more money from relatives living in the arrival cities of the West and the Persian Gulf than it gets from all agriculture combined, and in many years more than it gets from its entire garment industry and so on. This is a huge source of agricultural investment. Since 2008, the world has seen food shortages that have caused rising prices. So there's an urgent need to transform agriculture in many countries into something that produces larger amounts of food for people. And too many countries have sort of subscribed to the myth of the village as being an idyllic place that politicians need to preserve in its way. And this is preventing food production from increasing. Governments of India have been particularly unfortunate this way in a desire to finance people to stay in subsistence farming and so on. As a result, India, which should be one of the great food producers of the world, produces half as much food per acre as Europe does. There's no reason why it shouldn't be producing twice as much food, and that would be enough to end the whole problem. Sub-Saharan Africa, similarly, villages are used as places of mere survival, and an intelligent change of the way cities work to places that can support people who finance agriculture back in the village could turn Sub-Saharan Africa into the world's great breadbasket, one of the great productive areas, producing as much food as Southeast Asia.
So you say there is this potential for the growth of large-scale commercial agriculture that would be more productive. We get away from this kind of system.
It doesn't need to be large-scale. Yeah. I mean, I think people get scared away when you hear that term.
Uh-huh.
But, you know, it can be like England and France did, a shift to small farms with 20, 30, 40 employees. And small farming often is the more effective way to produce a lot of food in many countries. You don't need huge factory farms. Brazil has gone to very large-scale agriculture, and it has the benefits in that it doesn't eat up the rainforest as much as small farms do, which tend to constantly eat into the forest. But I think most countries, their farmers prefer to shift to a system where there's some consolidation of peasant holdings. You know, some people give up and move into the city, so holdings get a little bit larger, but it remains very small-level farming, but tied into futures markets and so on. I mean, poor African farmers in Ghana, they have something on their Nokia cell phone that ties them into futures markets, so they can find out what crop to plant each year. They can find the buyer willing to offer the best price. That sort of low-level technology turns farming from something where it's starvation versus survival into something where you can support your family and support the cities that depend on your farm.
But just what I have a caller here, I promise I'll get right to, but I just to not to put too fine a point on it, but this is something that is it just going to happen, or is it something that there has to be some deliberate government policy to smooth the path toward that?
Governments need to get involved, particularly in the transitional urban neighborhoods, to make sure that this shift, which will be driven by the economies that are happening anyway, happens in a way that's good for people, that allows them to fulfill their ambitions and doesn't create frustration and conflict and misery and so on. There needs to be attention paid to the transitional neighborhoods, investment in their needs.
All right. We have a caller in Atlanta, Illinois, not Georgia, here on our toll-free line. Hello.
Good morning. Mm-hmm. Great conversation, and one that is, you know, really controversial conversation. There's a lot of issues here that so far really haven't been covered, and one of them is energy and environmental concerns. And, in fact, one major environmental concern that might be worth discussing here in the short term is just if global warming is true. Most of the people have moved to large cities along coastal areas, and you know, I was talking to somebody in, you know, New York the other day. That is a concern, you know, that New York could be underwater. So that means a lot of major coastal cities will be underwater, and this is going to be pretty disruptive to cities in general. Do you think people at that time will maybe get fed up with cities and move back into the country where they have more control over the resources? That's the other problem, is that as resources diminish, I doubt if we're going to farm in the Sierra. We're just not going to have the resources available to do that kind of thing. So between resources and rising water tables, if global warming is true, what's going to happen to cities then?
That's an excellent question. And the effects of climate change are very important to understand in understanding how the urbanizing trend of the next few decades is likely to play out. And there are a few effects of this. First of all, there's the fact that there are three factors really at work when you talk about the effects of climate change. First of all, there is the improvement in living conditions that comes with the move to the city. The one thing we know about climate change, and all the studies show this, is that the people who will be most affected by climate change, who will be hurt the most, are those who are in absolute poverty, those who have family incomes of a dollar a day or less. And it tends to be rural populations who will be hurt the most by climate change, by rising ocean levels, by global warming and so on, particularly because they're in those poverty areas. So certainly shifting the slice of the pie of the world who are in that vulnerable position to be smaller, getting people out of the dollar a day or less range will help people defend against climate change in many ways, and so on. Second of all, there's the urban question. It's the big cities that will be able to defend themselves against the effects of rising ocean levels and climate change. I mean, London and Venice already have the physical barriers in place to protect themselves against even the largest projected ocean level increases. Singapore is investing in those sort of defenses. Mumbai can probably afford it. It's the bigger cities that have the economies of scale to be able to afford the mitigation against climate change's effects. But finally, in the cosmic sense, if I can put it that way, the root cause of the global warming trend, the melting ice caps and so on, which are very much real and measurable phenomena, is the rising human population, which has been, you know, the consistent phenomenon since the beginning of time. The thing that will end this will be the shift to cities. The United Nations Population Division tracks this very well, and universally around the world, when countries urbanize, their population starts shrinking. This is not a culturally variable thing. I point to the example of Iran again, which in the mid-1980s had an average of around 8 children per family, hugely growing population. Now, since this huge migration to the city, Iran has an average family size of 1.7 children per family. It has a fast-shrinking population. Despite having a religion, culture, and government that are not especially given to shouting about birth control, we know that in the larger sense, this shift to a shrinking world population will be necessary as a way to deal with the root causes of climate change, although certainly trying to find legislation and technology and so on is important as well. So in a number of ways, it's important. Now, mitigating that is the fact that when families urbanize, they tend to use more resources per person. That's certainly true, and that's a factor that's counterbalanced by the shrinking family size and so on, but it's worth keeping in mind. Nevertheless, the places that are the least vulnerable and the most able to deal with these effects will be the big cities. In terms of agriculture, yes, rising fuel costs will mean that transportation will be a more expensive part of the food cost mix. But that doesn't necessarily mean, despite what a lot of people say, that people will be growing closer to the cities where they live. What that means is you need to have agricultural enterprises that produce food at a far lower per unit cost of food. If it's the farms that are able to produce large volumes at low cost, and therefore the rising transportation costs will be offset by the low cost of the food, that I suspect will be dominant. And I have a feeling that, yes, transportation will be more expensive, but the way the farms will deal with this is by increasing yields dramatically.
Yeah, you've thought this out extremely well, and you answered my question pretty good. But on the other hand, the agricultural products will be vulnerable to energy use rather than to food use, and that's going to put pressure on them. But the one thing that you were really right on and really thought out was population is the lowest common denominator of the success of all of us. So cities for sure are a good place for people to be, and I can't believe how well you thought this out. So thank you.
Thanks. And just to you touched on this, but again, to underscore it, because I think it's a really interesting point and it might be something people didn't realize, is that this correlation between urbanization and family size, in the sense that people come to the city, they end up having smaller families because they don't need to have the number of children to work that they do back in the village.
Yeah, I mean, this is a near universal around the world. The other thing that happens is women become more important in family. And look, this is something that I don't think people realize is that among the very poor moving into the cities of the developing world, they're experiencing something that any middle-class North American knows, which is the fact that it's impossible to make ends meet without both the husband and wife working full-time. And this is true in the slums of China and India as much as it is in the suburbs of North America. And the effects of this there are several effects. First of all, it means that often in many of these countries, the women of the family are making more money than the men, which is profoundly transformative among the more religious and conservative cultures that move in from the village. I would point to the Hindu cultures of India, which have some of the most repressive gender relations in the village. Suddenly they move to the city, the women become the primary breadwinners, the men also have to work, the daughters become the ones who are headed toward education. That changes thinking. Now, it causes clashes and conflict, and it causes sometimes a reactionary conservatism among the families who are moving into the city, where you see people in the bottom-rung migrant neighborhoods in the arrival cities becoming actually more conservative than they were in the village as a defensive mechanism. But it also means that childcare becomes incredibly important. What do you do with the kids when both husband and wife are working 12 hours a day? In a factory, sometimes a factory with two-hour bus connections necessary to get there and back. Too often the kids end up being raised by the concrete pathways between the buildings in the West or in the mud pathways between huts in the developing world, and this leads them into gangs and crime and so on. I think there's a need for a worldwide crusade for day-long schooling. And when I looked at the poor and violent neighborhoods in places like Sao Paulo that were able to turn themselves around and become success stories, it was very often because in an emergency measure they'd introduced all-day schooling almost as a way to have a building for the kids to hide from bullets and so on, and realize that this is actually what's needed. Very few places in the world have all-day schooling for children. I mean, even Germany doesn't. So it's something that really needs to be thought out. It needs to be invested in and so on, because it provides both the education needed to get out of these situations, but it also provides something for children to do when in the realistic family situations of the new world.
Well, about 7-8 minutes left in this hour of focus. Doug Saunders is the guest. He is an award-winning journalist. He's the European bureau chief of the Globe and Mail newspaper, and he's the author of the new book, Arrival City, How the Largest Migration in History is Reshaping Our World. Takes a look at the movement of people from the rural to the urban. For the first time ever, we now have more people living in cities than in rural areas. Between 2007 and 2050, the world's cities will have absorbed 3.1 billion people. It is a mass movement, he argues, that will change the world. And the place where it happens is this place that he calls the Arrival City. And he spent time traveling to a number of them around the world and has written about them in the book. And questions are welcome, 333-9455 and toll-free 800-222-9455. Another point, I think you mentioned this, but again, I think it's worth going back to, and I think it's another fascinating point here, is that for many places, maybe a lot of places, that the arrival city ends up being the main source of rural development in the respect that people who go there, they send a lot of the money that they make back to their village. And in fact, I think that you've said that these remittances actually, if you add them all up, exceed the amount of money that countries around the world spend on development aid.
On foreign aid, that's right. Yes, very much so. And you get countries where often the largest source of international finance is remittances from family members in a city somewhere around the world. China, about 5 years ago, reported that remittances from relatives living in the city are now the largest source of rural income, larger than all food sales combined. And there's a lot of Chinese agriculture as well, so this is profound. China has 200 million people who have one foot in the village and one foot in an arrival city neighborhood in an urban area, what they call the floating population. But even Poland, for example, the farms that I visited, the rural areas there, are receiving more money from, you know, the oldest daughter working as an office cleaner in London than all of the EU and Polish farm subsidies plus food income combined. And this is financing development. I mean, sometimes it finances gaudy buildings and lavish shops designed to show off the wealth of the relatives who've moved to the city and so on. But it does provide a source of income that changes the arithmetic of the village from one of survival to one of production.
We have, as I said, maybe about 5 minutes. We have some other callers to talk with. So let's go next to Bloomington, I believe, line number 4, toll-free line. Hello.
One of the crying needs in these big mega cities is unemployment, or rather employment. I thought I understood that in China, one reason they don't encourage consolidation of farms, they want to keep people on the farms because they don't know what they would do with them if they all came to the cities.
Yeah, that's part of it. Although what's more interesting is that the reason why people are staying on the farms is that they often have half moved to the city, because that's certainly where the employment opportunities are. And I should note, China has labor shortages now, right? I mean, China does not have unemployment. It although in some regions it does. China has labor shortages in the millions, to the point that people in the Pearl River Delta in Guangdong, companies are now bringing in African immigrants to fill unfulfillable labor needs and so on. China also finances its industries through the enormous savings of village peasants. And there's a fear in the government that if they allow people to urbanize to the extent that the economy wants them to, that they'll stop saving at that rate. They'll start investing in housing and stuff like that, and they will lose their main source of finance capital for state-owned industries. So there's a real fear of a transition that probably needs to happen in China.
All right. Again, let's go to Belgium here. I guess that would be the toll-free line. Now it's on line number 1. Hello. Go ahead.
Yes. Good morning to you all. And I've got one question, maybe a final question for you. Can a city get too big?
People used to think so. And there are problems with cities that sprawl out into the countryside too far, that aren't contained within areas. But there's been a change in thinking in recent years that the largest cities are often the ones that are economically and ecologically most able to cope with large-scale movements of people inwards. It may be the biggest cities that are best able to control the problems of growth, the problems of environmental change, and so on. Efforts to shift people in medium-sized cities have not worked all that well, although, you know, smaller cities have an important role as well. There's a fear of the city, including among the people who live in the city, self-mythology of it as a dangerous place and so on, which is often at odds with the actual reality of it. I mean, I was visiting Toronto, my hometown, where people in newspapers endlessly believe that it's a crime-ridden city filled with dangerous immigrants and so on. In fact, it's the 23rd most crime-ridden city in Canada, and I can't even name 23 cities in Canada, which is probably the least crime-ridden Western city in the world and so on. So I think there needs to be sort of a sea change in thinking and realizing that having a tightly packed agglomeration of people can actually be an improvement in life and a more sustainable and ecological form of life. That is actually full of many more opportunities than dangers.
We maybe have about 2 minutes left. One thing here I do want to come back to. Given that you talked earlier about how this transition we're talking about either can be handled well or badly, and that can make a big difference in how countries develop and how they are governed. So given that, what sort of things do you think that governments can do to try to actually, you know, if you think of these areas as being incubators of the countries, of the future middle class and people who are going to contribute to the country, what can governments do to actually help?
Three things. They need to provide the physical connections to the economy. Transportation routes are very, very important, and tighter density of housing and so on. They need to remove bureaucratic barriers, remove zoning, allow people to start small businesses, allow people to put their kids into education and so on. And they need to allow pathways to full citizenship. The worst thing that can happen to a country is to have a large population within its borders who do not have a pathway to full legal citizenship. They won't have the incentive to improve their neighborhood, to buy their housing, to start businesses, to put kids in university. Instead, they will be forced to turn to underground and illegal sources of living. And Germany made this mistake by having 2 million Turks in its arrival city neighborhoods for 40 years who had no route to citizenship. They became a dangerous underclass, while the Turks in other cities who had pathways to citizenship became important parts of the new middle class and so on. I worry that the United States could make this mistake as well by not providing pathways to legal citizenship to people who've come in through illegitimate means.
Mm. Well, are there a lot of places where the arrival cities, where a lot of the population are not already citizens of that country? That is, not only have they moved from the country to the city, but they've moved to that city from some other country.
Large amounts of migration are done because the economy demands people, but it's not necessarily legal. And really, I mean, if you have ancestors who came from Europe during the last century, they probably didn't come in legally. They probably were given their citizenship later in amnesties and so on. That's a very normal way to move and so on. When the economy demands people, they'll come in. So one of my messages, I don't particularly have an opinion as to whether there should be more or less immigration, but my message is that we should be planning not for what we'd like to happen, but for what is going to happen. Assuming the economy gets going again, there will be people moving in large enough numbers to fill the labor shortages. They will be settling down in these bottom-rung neighborhoods. We should be putting the things in place to make these neighborhoods into the next wave of success rather than it's the next trouble spot.
All right. Well, for people who want to read more on the story, the book that you should look at is just out. The title is Arrival City, How the Largest Migration in History is Reshaping Our World. Pantheon is the publisher, by our guest, Doug Saunders. He's an award-winning journalist, European Bureau Chief of the Globe and Mail. So a very ambitious reporting project, and I think it's quite a fascinating story, and I certainly appreciate you giving us some of your time.
Thank you. It was a real pleasure.
You've been listening to a program from the Focus Archives. The show was first broadcast March 31st of this year. You can catch up on some of our past programs, those that you may have missed. In fact, you can consult the schedule and see upcoming shows to make sure that you don't miss programs that you really want to hear. All of that is available on our website, and that is WILL.illinois.edu.
Support for Focus comes from Body Work Associates, offering professional licensed massage therapy to Champaign-Urbana since 1982, with four area locations, inside the ARC, the Illini Student Union, and on Windsor Road in Champaign. More information is available at bodyworkassociates.com.
Hi, I'm Kevin Kelly, host of Live and Local on FM 90.9. Join me each weekday at noon for an hour of conversation with local musicians and other performers, as well as guest artists visiting our listening area. We feature frequent live performances in our studio and a daily calendar of events you can see and hear live. It's Live and Local, your connection to local music and more, weekdays from noon to 1 on FM 90.9.
In just a moment here, we'll be taking the usual break we do at this point so we can bring you a commodity market update. In the second hour of the show, we will have another installment in something that I decided to call the Deep Archives Project. And this is something that we're doing to mark the fact that this program, Focus, and when we started, we called it Focus 580. The show's been on the air for 30 years. February was actually the anniversary. So we thought it'd be interesting to go back and bring back some of the oldest interviews that we have in our tape library. These are programs that exist on cassette. They are not part of the online archive that we have. And so these are programs that haven't been heard in a very long time. What we tried to do is pick things that we thought would be interesting because of the guest and because of the topic. And in the second hour today, you'll hear two very different takes on beauty, how we think about beauty. So we hope that you will stay with us and be with us for hour number two. Right now, though, as we usually do, we'll take a break so we can bring you some news from National Public Radio. And before that, an update on the commodity market. So please stay tuned.
Good morning, everyone. This is Dave Dickey with a look at the commodity markets, where at mid-session at the Chicago Board of Trade, corn futures, which had languished to the downside for much of the morning, has found renewed strength, as has wheat. the soybean market just marginally lower at this hour. Remember, this is the last trading day before a extended three-day weekend. The trade expected to come back and look really hard at the 10-day weather forecast on Monday night, as well as on Tuesday afternoon when NASS releases its late crop progress reports. Let's look at the market now. July wheat in Kansas City at 9.52, up 9 1/4. The December at 9.33 3/4, up 9. July wheat at the Chicago Board of Trade, 8.24, up 9 1/2. December, 9.15 3/4, up 8 3/4. July corn, 7.53, up 7 1/2. September, 7.24, up 5 3/4. December, 6.79 1/4. It's up 3. March of 2012, 6.90, up 1 3/4. May, 6.90, 6 1/2, up 4.